lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Will Miller, a political scientist, currently serving as Executive Director of Analytics, Effectiveness, and Strategic Planning at Jacksonville University. And I'm happy today to be joined by Brian Smankowski, faculty member in political science and director of the Center of Teaching and Learning at the University of Idaho. It's a fun week to talk. I feel like we have a nice mix of international and domestic issues and borderline scandals and questions about what's next coming. Who would have guessed? You know, it's another week as the world turns in American politics. But I figured we should really probably start with what I think is probably the biggest story from the week, and that's the attack on the Saudi Arabian refineries. Obviously, we knew there was a drone attack. We know that we've had a significant amount of damage done to the Saudi Arabian pipeline at this point as a result of this. I think it was interesting early in the week, especially. I remember getting, you know, email messages from people telling me I had to go get gas because the mass shortage and the $8 a gallon gas was coming, and this was the worst thing to ever happen, which I think that's kind of died down a little bit now, especially with Trump and the reserves. But now, obviously, the bigger question is, you know, sort of who did this? Why did they do this? What impact is there? What do we do in response? If it's obviously, you know, if we do have tangible proof that this really was coming out of Iran, coming out of Tehran, I think it definitely changes the scope of those conversations and probably introduces the idea that Trump's been floating, of course, of there having to be some type of response to what's happened. But, you know, I don't know if we know that for sure yet. So in general, what are your thoughts on what happened, the impact it'll have, and what do you see us doing sort of in response to it?
I think it was caught up in the same whirlwind, Will, that, you know, we saw the immediate response about what this is going to do to oil prices. But really, you know, coming back to the main question of the who, the why, and the what, we know that there was an attack that by all indications indicates that it was a sophisticated, planned, executed attack. The data and artifacts gathered by Saudi Arabia clearly indicated that it was sponsored by Iran. Iran's policy statement officially is, nope, wasn't us. So, you know, here's on one side, the gathering of all the evidence and the debris saying we could track this very specifically and directly back to Iran. Iran, as we know, was sort of like testing the American metal and the world's metal when they shot down a drone over the Straits of Hormuz recently. And I think that these two things are actually very related, because when we think about what happened a couple of weeks ago, and I think we discussed this in our last episode, why would Iran do this? What is their interest? I think on one hand, they're trying to do things that can manipulate the positioning of other forces to relieve the strain of sanctions against them. But they're also realizing in real time that the American response going back to June was not swift and decisive. And the response now from the administration is also one of, you know, pause and hesitancy. And, you know, the goal of the administration right now arguably is to defer conflict in the Middle East, not wanting conflict in the Middle East. But here we increasingly have evidence of a very clear attack that can provoke the United States, and what is the United States going to do about it? And I think there's a more brazen approach being taken by leadership in Iran right now. It still fears military might from the United States. There's no doubt about that. But I think it doesn't think it's going to be invoked.
And that's an interesting component, because I think you're right. I mean, they're acting in a way that they assume there's nothing coming back. Which I think historically they'd probably be accurate on. But what do you think gives them the ability to think that way when Donald Trump is in office? And admittedly, I'm not sure we've been able to predict anything Donald Trump has done particularly well over the last 2.5 years. I mean, Donald Trump is the type of president. I mean, and, you know, he's not joked, but I mean, he's more often than any other president raised the possibility of using nuclear weapons as being sort of an option. If not an end game for some conflicts. If you're Iran, what gives you that comfort level that you can do this in the middle of asking for a lessening of sanctions and think that there's not going to be something coming back.
One of the things that we addressed in our last show, Will, was that Iran, I think, it doesn't operate in a consequence-free environment, but I think it is in a much less risk-aversive position. Its economy is kind of, you know, tanking, right? It's not in a very stable position. And so what I think the Iranian leadership is embracing is, what if we shifted our thinking? What if we moved to a more aggressive posture? And I was doing a little bit of research on a topic recently. And, you know, when you look at some of the work that's coming out of some of the Middle East research and political risk analysis camps, they're arguing effectively that the Iranian elites have clearly taken on a harder line, more risk accepting policy position. And so Iran doesn't want war. Iran still has this fear of U.S. military might and military power. But I think it's clearly saying, but the one thing we could do right now is we could push the envelope. We could see how far we could go in order to dismantle the oil production of another country that could destabilize the alliances that exist there and the dependence that exists there and enforce attention in our direction. So I think it's not trying to deliberately provoke the United States to a military response. I think they're banking on the fact that despite the promises of fire and fury from the Trump administration, they have all the evidence in the world that the administration is not going to do it. And I think that the June Strait of Hormuz attack on the drone demonstrates that they don't see a response. Now, what does that do for the U.S.? You know, we have a shifting of power with Bolton stepping out and O'Brien stepping in. And, you know, we have some pretty hard line, not risk averse of people in the administration, despite the revolving door in that position. But I think the question is, how far can Iran push it without having military retaliation? And from the U.S. foreign policy perspective, the question is this the fulcrum? Is this the tipping point where we say, yes, if it is clearly proven that it was Iran, there needs to be an immediate military response?
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I think that's where I am. If this is something where we can prove back that this was Iran, we definitely need to respond. The benefit, I think, of a response in this type of scenario is that, I mean, obviously, I don't think we're talking about ground troops. I think we're talking about very strategic tactical airstrikes on some key areas. But I do think you're right. I mean, it seems like Iran has been sort of, you know, it's the equivalent of a child pushing mom and dad's buttons. Where this has been a, let's see how far we can stretch this. Let's see what the canary does in the coal mine. Let's see when we actually get the reaction that we're looking for. I think the question will just be what we respond with and whether they ultimately view that as being, you know, somewhat reciprocal or not. I think the interesting part for me is if all this attention focuses in on airstrikes in a place like Iran, I'm going to be incredibly curious for a president who's been very good at deflection, to see what all happens domestically and what other things go under the radar during whatever time frame that takes. You know, I obviously think this is a president who, for making good use of his office and his powers in the American media and American public opinion, has been able to focus on some things while getting us to look somewhere else. And this would definitely be another opportunity to do that. I think the big question obviously then becomes we end up in a game where however we respond is ultimately going to start to draw the line on exactly how far the Iranians are willing to go in response. And I'm not sure what the answer to that question is either right now.
No, but I think you hit the nail right on the head there, Will, because, you know, let's face it, Trump's numbers have not, you know, improved. We're looking ahead to 2020. And while I think that there still is a pathway to victory that his administration clearly sees, you know, even reports from Fox News are indicating that he's more vulnerable for the 2020 election than he appeared just even a few weeks ago. There's nothing like a good rally around the flag moment to galvanize your base, right? And so if there is something that's short-term, calculated, successful, devoid of casualties on our side, strategically implemented by our side, and decisive in terms of having some demonstrated impact that Iran's behavior was stopped by this move, then I think that's a very powerfully galvanizing thing. And I'm not talking about for Trump as a human being, as a person. Regardless of who the president is, these things typically work out very well for the person sitting in the White House at that moment. It is a great diversion from domestic policy issues that might be going on. There's no doubt about that. So timing is really going to matter. The biggest question is, and I'm confident, I've got to be confident, that this is what foreign policy experts within the administration are thinking is, we need not to just think about what our response is going to be. We need to really think about what the Iranian response to our response would be. Because if we do something that shuts something down and stops something, then we have a clear victory. If we do something that provokes this back and forth thing, I think the American appetite for prolonged engagement, the American appetite for investment in a military effort in the Middle East isn't really there. But I think it would be there for something short, sweet, clear, concise, and strategically successful. But I also don't know how much the American public is paying attention to what's going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia right now. So I don't know if to the administration, this seems like it's salient enough in the court of American public opinion to matter.
But I mean, I think that's the key. I think they can make this salient. And I think the way they can do that and the way it can play into an electoral strategy like you're talking about is to let gas prices go up. If I'm Donald Trump right now, having gas prices go up to $3.50, $3.75, $4 a gallon and being able to pinpoint that on the Iranian attack in Saudi Arabia, assuming that's what ultimately comes out of the facts here, I think that's an electoral win too, because the people that are going to be hit most by that in a lot of ways are going to be the Trump voters that Democrats believe are susceptible to going back to Democrats in 2020. So getting them back in the camp of Democrats don't want to do anything, they don't want to challenge, gas prices are high because these people did this, and we're going to go blow the crap out of them for a few days. I think you're right. That rally around the flag, and it also just gets at that raw politicalness of these situations and might make it very salient for voters when otherwise it isn't.
I agree. I think it's one of those things where, you know, taking from communications, it's a strategy of you can follow what's salient and tracking in the news, or you could define what the news is going to be. And I think at a moment at which the administration sees that this could be something that you could fabricate the news in this regard and spin it in a way that works to your advantage, because, you know, whether you love, hate, or Trump hate, one of the things that we do recognize is his ability to basically craft the message that gets play. So if he argues that, look, the American public interest was compromised and was put at stake, and the good, hardworking middle class of America is going to suffer the most by these crippling gas prices, we're doing this in our best interest. And I think he can mold the news in that direction. Ideally, I would like to see a reversion to diplomatic channels. I would like to see this be a victory for diplomacy. I would like it to be something that if it is demonstrated clearly and convincingly that Iran was behind this, then I would like to see a bringing to the table of representatives from, you know, all three sides in this, and try to figure out what the diplomatic response would be, move them back to using diplomatic challenges. Because one of the things that we're seeing right now is that when Iran feels provoked or Iran feels vulnerable, they're responding with military action rather than responding through diplomatic channels. And I think from my standpoint, I would like to see the diplomatic channels be brought back to the center of the table.
I don't disagree with that. I just wonder when diplomacy isn't enough. I feel like we've been talking. I feel like they've had exchanges. And to some extent, I feel like the Iranians don't really want to sit down with Trump, especially.
I think you're right. I think it's like any relationship, right? When it's one side, then it's not going to work. So we could be talking all we want about the need to work through diplomatic channels. But if the other side is saying, I agree, we should work through diplomatic channels. Oh, by the way, this wasn't us. Then something else gets blown up and it looks like you did it. That makes it difficult. So that's why sometimes we're talking about hopes and wishes, right? That we always prefer that diplomatic channels are going to work. We would like to think that the sanctions would have had a greater impact. But I think what's happening is that the combination of sanctions and a floundering economy is creating a more vulnerable state. And when you're in a position of vulnerability, it's not quite like the animal that's backed into a corner, but desperation and desperate measures are resorted to a little bit more easily and a little bit more frequently. And in this case, I honestly think that Iran is simply trying to define where that line is and pushing as far up against that line without retaliation as it can go.
And the thing, too, that I think we're not mentioning that's important and hasn't been coming up in these stories, the sanctions work a lot better against Iran if they don't have the Chinese sitting there helping them out to some extent. And we can debate that all day long. But, I mean, they are still doing this from a position of power where, you know, you're right, the animal backed into the corner. This is, you know, this is the equivalent to me of, you know, a poodle being backed into a corner by a snake, but it knows it has a Rottweiler standing behind it, too. Where, you know, there's still some backing. This isn't a pariah country that's out there on its own, which I think makes it even more dangerous in a lot of ways because they know that, you know, the U.S. probably can't economically completely block them out of the rest of the world at this point.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, when we think about the game of enemies and allies, you know, we saw this even with conversations about NATO. And then, you know, the spirit of NATO, it's, you know, an attack on one is an attack on all, and there's this demand for a collective response. I mean, we haven't seen that since the attack of 9/11. And I, you know, I'm not saying that too much as a sidebar, but it's really not, I mean, well, Iran is in a very vulnerable position economically and politically. They're not alone in the world. And I think you're right that when you start thinking about who's supporting this kind of increasingly rogue nation in a way, it's, yeah, it's the poodle with the Rottweiler in the background. I hope that callers don't, you know, start responding saying, hey, I have a Rottweiler.
I know, as soon as I said it, I was like, I'm going to hear from poodle and Rottweiler owners this week, but that's okay.
Then again, most Rottweiler owners will be like, you're damn right, that's my Rottweiler
that's
for
you.
That's
why I got them. I ain't getting them because they're cute and fluffy.
Yep.
Let's switch gears a little bit. You mentioned Robert O'Brien, and it kind of builds into that same story. I mean, what a week to take over as National Security Advisor for the president. Obviously, with John Bolton forced resigning, being fired, whatever terminology we're using, but no longer being in the White House, Trump was obviously going to do some type of search. And I'll tell you, it's interesting because I read a CNN op-ed, definitely left-leaning, wasn't, you know, great to read, but it was an interesting point that it raised about the fact that we can put whoever we want in that office. At the end of the day, Donald Trump appears to be his own national security advisor. He talked openly about, you know, whoever gets hired is going to have this opportunity to work for me, this great president, and on and on and on. And he talked openly about the five finalists. And then we ended up with O'Brien, who now gets to inherit for, you know, point one, probably this fund between Iran and Saudi Arabia. What do you think about O'Brien? What do you think about the role of the National Security Advisor in general? Is this something that's valuable to presidents? Is this something with today's information age that's becoming less necessary? What do you think?
I would say that with the current administration, it's more necessary than ever to have somebody who can advise on national security issues. One of the problems with the Trump administration is Trump himself, in that he presumes himself to know more about everything than anybody. And he's the universal expert. You know, he's the guy who boldly proclaimed that he knows more than the five-star generals. And, you know, that's a very disruptive and bold statement to make, you know, from somebody who's had no military experience, somebody who's had no diplomatic experience, nobody who's had any foreign policy training, service, or education. So on one hand, I would say that we definitely need, you know, right now in this administration, a national security advisor who could give sage advice. The problem is that we have a president who doesn't want advice. I honestly think that what the president is looking for is somebody who's going to validate whatever assumption and validate even whatever stereotype that he has. And that's going to become the frame for U.S. foreign policy. So I think that regardless of who walks in through the revolving door of this role, it's going to be to serve that leader and that leader's perspective on global affairs, not the other way around. I don't think the president, you know, he didn't lean on John Bolton. He's not going to lean on O'Brien. You know, they're different characters in appearance only. You know, here's a guy who really, I'm not going to say he's unfit for the position, but I would argue that he's only marginally qualified at best.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's one of those positions where, you know, at the end of the day, the qualifications are whatever the president really wants. Which with Trump in office definitely changes the dynamic. I mean, there were rumors and reports that Trump was going to push Mike Pompeo to try to take that position, which would have been a dramatic change in position and power, but was really geared at if you're out of the State Department, you have more ability to assist in ways that you can't in the public light, I guess, would be the way to phrase it. But I agree. I mean, with O'Brien, it's that question of, is this just a figurehead, or is this somebody that Trump's actually going to listen to? When the position runs well, it should be somebody with senior knowledge, but that involves the individuals in the room looking at them as if they have senior knowledge. And that is something that Trump has obviously struggled with, as we've noticed, you know, kind of a rapid succession of individuals in a lot of different places inside of the White House, and what that ultimately means for his ability to lead. I guess the question I come back to is, did it really matter who Trump put in this position? Did it even make a difference whether it was Robert O'Brien or Will Miller or Brian Smikowski? Do you think there's a difference we'll be able to point to because he's there versus somebody else?
Nope. I'm convinced that it's not going to really make a difference. You know, here's a guy whose claim to fame, you know, we're talking about O'Brien in his capacity, was, you know, most recently defending an American rapper who was charged for assault in Sweden, right? Here's a person who, I mean, yes, people could say in his defense that he's a hostage negotiator, but really what he is a corporate attorney. And I'm not going to get into, you know, whether he's a good corporate attorney or he's a bad corporate attorney. He's somebody who has earned the president's trust and admiration. He's somebody who could step in and say, you're right, I agree, and I don't think it's going to make a damn bit of difference, Will.
Yeah, and I don't either. I mean, I think it's, you know, the ship has sailed, and as you said, Trump is going to find somebody who supports his views, well-founded or otherwise. But I do think, going back to the Iran-Saudi Arabia conversation, it is going to be something where he's going to find somebody who is okay with action being taken. I think that's a reality of where we are now, that Trump has talked a lot of good talk about foreign affairs, but I think, you know, to some extent, he's ready to go toe-to-toe in some of these scenarios, and this is probably the one that now has the biggest shot directly across the bow aimed at the U.S., even if it's obviously tangentially through Saudi Arabia.
I agree, and I think that one of the things that might potentially be a small difference is the appearance does matter. So here you've got, you know, John Bolton, who was had very distinctive features. And in many respects, he was like, if you asked a bunch of people of a certain generation, including ours, draw the picture of the modern hawk, right? You would draw John Bolton. If you said, draw the vision of the modern hawk, it's not going to look like Robert O'Brien. So I think Bolton was harder to separate from the hawkish posture. And one of the jokes that immediately came out among some of my friends was, well, Bolton came in and left, and the world wasn't annihilated. So, yay, victory. What's O'Brien going to do? O'Brien is more similar than different than Bolton, I think, in terms of his very muscular approach to foreign policy, not being afraid to flex that military might muscle. And also, you know, here's a guy who wrote about America basically being asleep at a critical point in American foreign policy that necessitates a more muscular position right now. Now, the question still comes back to whether or not the United States is going to move beyond flexing that muscle or exerting the strength that's behind that muscle.
Agreed. And I mean, I think the one thing about all of this that keeps coming into my mind is Donald Trump wants to get reelected. And I think that's probably playing a role in anything he does over the next year, year and a half. And I wonder how that's going to impact his decision making on Iran. And that could be a blessing for Democrats in some cases, because that might ground him into some better choices. I mean, I feel like Trump is not publicly going down the Nixonian path of this election just becoming his entire life, but he's pretty darn close, and he has been since the day he was originally sworn in as president. So I think that's one variable to just keep our eyes on is, mm-hmm. you know, as he goes in the polls, as this starts out, how does he react, and what's he looking to do on that bounce from what you said as he creates the news?
Yep. Yep, I agree.
So let's switch gears again. Obviously, a lot of news this week about Brett Kavanaugh back in the news, and it's not for being a Supreme Court justice this time. Mm-hmm. The New York Times also in the news. New York Times having to do a lot of cleanup after basically admitting that they have misreported on this new allegation against Kavanaugh. And for listeners that have somehow managed to not see this week, ultimately the New York Times runs an essay in Sunday Review focusing on a book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, that was really focusing on the culture at Yale. It wasn't just about Kavanaugh. It wasn't about him being a Supreme Court justice necessarily. But ultimately, the book includes an accusation that really seemed weak from the start. The Times has kind of admitted at this point it was too weak to have actually gone to press. And ultimately, in that case, the woman who was said to be involved refused to be interviewed. Her friend said that she didn't remember what happened. They were basing this all off of an individual who was at a party and witnessed something that the person that it was being done to does not remember, and nobody else at the party remembers, and he reported it to a few senators and the FBI, and then the New York Times ran with it. So I guess I have a couple of questions here. Number one, has the New York Times harmed itself? Have they done enough in response? Number two, what does this mean for Kavanaugh? And then number three, ultimately, is really just the question of, again, where are we at the relationship between the press and political figures today? What can we expect to see? How has Trump blown up the traditional model? What does that mean in the future? So I don't know where you want to start there, Brian, but there's some options for you.
Yeah, there's a lot. Well, let's go with the whirlwind effect. That on one hand, will the New York Times, you know, endure this? You know, of course it will. I mean, the New York Times is the New York Times, and you know, I'm sure some listeners are going to be, you know, read into that whatever they want to read into that. But it's endured bigger storms than this. One of the things that I do wonder about is if we're all sort of like caught up in the same whirlwind of, we got to get it out there. We got to get it out there. We got to get it out there. And we're seeing this with, you know, congressional hearings. We're seeing this with investigations. We're seeing this with media reporting. And there's a big push to get something out there and draw attention to it. And then if the attention that's drawn to it doesn't result in anything tangible happening, it just leads to a broader degree of cynicism. And as cynicism gets levied against, you know, in this case with the Lewandowski hearings, we're seeing the, you know, an obvious portrayal of Lewandowski, but we're seeing a portrayal of the American Congress as well. With what's happening with Kavanaugh, we're seeing a portrayal of Kavanaugh as a Supreme Court justice, but we're also seeing a portrayal of the responsibility or irresponsibility of the press. One of the things that I would fall back on is that in this regard with the Times, while it might have been jumping the gun, we have a right to be wrong. We have a right to sometimes, we make mistakes, right? And I think there's a bigger thing that's at issue here, and Kavanaugh's behavior has actually, you know, it's been generating a lot of attention in a lot of circles that might not be on the average listener's radar screen. There are legal scholars that are looking a little bit more closely and a little bit more creatively about what does the Constitution mean? Not just what does the Constitution say or what is our perception, but what does the Constitution mean and what did it mean at the time of the founding with regard to good behavior of a justice of the Supreme Court? We have had some of the Democratic candidates come out and say, we need to impeach Kavanaugh. I mean, surprisingly, not surprisingly, the same people who are saying impeach Trump are saying impeach Kavanaugh. And we know that impeachment is a very tricky process, but are there other means and mechanisms that can trigger somebody like Kavanaugh being removed from the bench or removing himself from the bench?
And I'm curious about that, though.
Yeah.
Because here's my thought. Like, we talk about impeaching. Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed. He was confirmed with all of America knowing that he had some sketchiness in his past that we needed to think about, and he was still confirmed. Wouldn't it make sense that the man can only be impeached at this point for either directly lying under oath during the confirmation hearing and having that be factually proven without a shadow of a doubt, or for actions that he's taken after he's confirmed? And again, I'm not saying legally even necessary, but I mean, logically, that just makes sense to me. If we know you have this checkered past, you get appointed, you get confirmed anyways, what gives us the right to go back later and say, you know, we rethought that and we've decided to do it differently this time?
You know, I was looking back because this is in the fun part of my wheelhouse of constitutional law. And I'm thinking about, you know, the Samuel Chase days and the Abe Fortas days, right? These were the two, really the only times in American history that impeachment was seriously pursued against justices sitting on the United States Supreme Court. And their circumstances were somewhat different. You know, with Chase, the argument was that, you know, he was a guy who was blatantly and overtly political, and does that matter? And that could actually have some bearing on Kavanaugh in this moment. Has his behavior been, and is his behavior still patently and overtly political and partisan in nature? I think anybody who would go back to the hearings would see it as less a demonstration of judicial temperament than a demonstration of intemperament and also a high degree of partisanship towards the appointing president. Secondly, with Abe Fortas, you know, Abe Fortas is the justice who famously retired based upon ethics allegations brought against him, right? So one of the questions was, would Abe Fortas have been impeached? And even if impeachment proceedings had run its course, here's a person who had a past history of some ethically questionable behavior, and it involves money, right? And taking payments for doing talks and things like this. But also, these things happened while he was in office. So I think the severability issue here is how much of Kavanaugh's past gets to come back and haunt him in his present role, or under the good behavior clause of the Constitution, does it have to be behavior that's occurring while he is in a position of Supreme Court justice, right? So I think that, you know, clearly it would be the case that if he did any of these things while he was a sitting Supreme Court justice, he'd be out of here. But even the past, the fact of the matter is, like, let's assume that it was something other than an allegation that has been levied against him. Let's assume it's another thing. Now, we have evidence of a crime. You know, he committed a murder back in 1985 or something like that. Would we say, hey, look, we all knew he was an axe murderer, and, you know, we went through the hearings knowing he was an axe murderer, and we've forgiven the axe murdering? I think this tells us a little bit about what a public appetite is, you know, even along gender lines, even along issues of violation of ethics and morality and the role of women in American society. I think his behavior, by all indications, was not that of a model citizen. And I think that the public and the Republicans in Congress clearly indicated that sexually inappropriate behavior is not the most important thing in their professed wheelhouse.
I think that's fair. And it just, it comes back to me, the blurring of the personal and the political. And again, not defending Kavanaugh's past or what he's even joked about or talked about. But the idea of, I mean, if you go back to the 70s, and not suggesting we should, but just looking at individuals, I mean, I grew up in Ohio. There's Wayne Hayes and Wilbur Mills who have, you know, hookers basically on their payroll. You have DUIs. You have all of these very public things. And they keep getting reelected, even though people know about it. I mean, heck, I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio. Jim Trafficant would have been there forever if they didn't put him in federal prison. People just didn't care. And I'm not saying that that's the same response to Kavanaugh or that the allegations against him are similar to those. But just big picture, it concerns me when we start getting so into the personal side, and it's not just at the time of confirmation, but it's we're going to keep digging forever. And in the Kavanaugh case, in all honesty, I mean, I get why the New York Times ran the story. I think it was egregious. I think it was a mistake. I don't think they should have, but that was a story, to your point, that people definitely wanted to hear. And my biggest concern was that they didn't really have it corroborated by anybody directly involved. It was one person who said they saw something when nobody else saw it. But I do worry about, you know, what becomes newsworthy then. Because you're right, the New York Times is going to survive. This is not going to be a problem. Hell, the New York Times is probably going to get a few extra subscribers from liberals in the country that are saying, we want to read more about this. And it's not going to sit there and have conservatives that have been, you know, liking the New York Times all of a sudden say, oh, that's the last straw for me. Those people are already in their camps. Traditional readership's going to be fine. But it's just that question of, when are you safe? And what does it mean for future nominees potentially? If I look at what some judge candidates have gone through, and again, Kavanaugh deserves the criticism, deserves the increased skepticism, but it has to beg the question of, you know, is it even worth going for the Supreme Court if they're going to dig this much in and twist and turn? And does that mean that all of a sudden, you know, our best legal scholars are saying we have no interest in this because we don't like the process? I mean, people tend to forget, and I bring it up on the show all the time, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was not in Bill Clinton's top 100 candidates for that Supreme Court seat. George Stephanopoulos talks openly about it in All Too Human, where Ginsburg was like a page 9, maybe, sort of, could be, after everybody else said no. Mario Cuomo turned down that Supreme Court seat multiple times throughout the process because he had a non-resident alien that was here illegally as a housekeeper, and he was afraid that that would make the news and he would lose all credibility. So we end up not with first choice, not with potentially a better legal mind. You end up with what you can get for what you're looking at. The days of George W. Bush nominating Harriet Myers and looking at non-pedigree law schools, that becomes reality if all the pedigree law school students are sitting there saying, my God, I don't need them to know about the time I played Puff Puff Pass at a dorm party. So I worry about what it means for the future of what these folks are actually supposed to do. Because from everything I've read and heard, including what we've seen from liberals on the court, Kavanaugh's been a stand-up justice, and if anything, I think he's leaned further left than people thought he would in his initial decisions.
Well, I think, you know, a couple things. You know, you really brought up a lot of different topics there. I think that in terms of his judicial behavior, he hasn't done anything that's really, I don't think, you know, surprised anybody too much, but I don't think that he clearly established himself on the farthest end of the tail of the right wing. You know, he hasn't really put himself out there in that regard. But if we go back to what this means for the future of judicial appointments and for the process, I think it's really indistinguishable from any other political institution. And, you know, sometimes we separate the courts out and say the courts are the apolitical institution. And while they are, while they're not publicly accountable at this level in a federal system, it's still fundamentally a political institution, right? The same rules of the game apply with regard to shuttle diplomacy and negotiation and wheeling and dealing. And there's a high degree of public scrutiny. I think there was a time when, you know, it's hard to say. Was there a time when public scrutiny didn't matter as much? You know, I would say no. You know, I think that if we go back to the Abe Fortas era, for example, and even the Samuel Chase era, you know, we go back to Jefferson. I mean, fundamentally, there were always questions about reining in Supreme Court justices, observing their behavior, looking at temperament, because one of the things that Supreme Court justices have the rare opportunity to do among this very small body, and despite the will of the people and 535 legislators and a president, the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of the day has the authority to say what the Constitution means, and in so doing, sometimes overrule what looks like the democratic will of the people and American government. Now, if you're going into that role of the Supreme Court, just like any other politician, you know everybody's going to go into your closet. And you know that you've had closets since you were a little itty-bitty kid. So one of the questions that comes up is, what really matters to the voters? And I think in some regards, and this will go back to a when I was on jury duty one time, it was a case where somebody did something that by my standards was unacceptable behavior. Yet somebody else on the jury made a comment. He goes, well, there, but for the grace of God, go all of us. And I'm like, wow. But then I think about public opinion on issues like this. And I'm sure that there's a large cross section of the American public who says, we've all done stupid things in our past. We've all had youthful indiscretions. There's a point at which you say, that's what it means to become an adult. The question is, what's the scale of egregious behavior? And, you know, we've seen this come up even with Joe Biden. Has he said and done and aligned himself with people in a matter that could be stupid? Of course he has. Do people evolve and grow and emerge, you know, differently throughout their political and social careers? Absolutely. So the question is, how much of this stuff should be, you know, I don't want to say how much of it should stick. I don't want to stoke the fires that way. I do think Kavanaugh probably is thinking, I did this stuff a long time ago. Why does it keep coming back? To the public opinion, the question is, should it come back and should it matter? And I think the public is pretty clearly divided on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's definitely that division. And I think Kavanaugh is thinking that. And again, like I said, from my end, I wish it didn't keep coming back up, because I think we know that the end game is, you know, even Jerry Nadler, who we're going to talk about in a minute, has made it clear that there's not going to be an impeachment hearing against Brett Kavanaugh. So the question is, what's the end game by continuing to hit on this versus trying to do things to prevent this from happening again? And, you know, that's always going to be the balance and the difficulty. But Kavanaugh knew the extra scrutiny was coming. He's done nothing to really prevent the extra scrutiny. And, you know, ultimately, he's going to keep having to answer for these allegations as they emerge. It's just a question of how long they last for, I guess.
But you know, this isn't really just about Kavanaugh. You know that this is really a way of saying, let's focus on Kavanaugh to call into question the judgment of Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
So that's what, you know, to me, it's make no mistake. Right now, any, you know, with Kavanaugh's judicial behavior in the present moment not doing anything remarkably disruptive, this is really being brought up to say, Let's look at Trump. Let's look at judgment. Let's look at reason. Let's look at the administration. And really, the Democrats are trying to do, in some regards, what the Republicans are trying to do to the Democrats, which is put together a narrative that defines the party. And we see the party in Congress, we see the party in the White House, we see the party in the courts. So the Democrats are basically trying to characterize the Republicans as the party that accepts this kind of behavior while we don't. And we saw this even with people like Al Franken stepping down for, you know, with in the Me
Too.
For
a lot less, to be honest. And I do not like Al Franken, but.
Well, but, you know, Al Franken, you know, would be regarded as an integrity move, right?
Yep, absolutely.
He stepped down. He said, you know, what it
did
was
wrong.
With
no fanfare, really. It was just the, yep, this is it. Got to go.
Yep. And I think one of the assumptions was on the Democrat side is, look at us. We're better. We meet these criticisms and we do the right and noble thing. What are you going to do, Republicans? And I think they're saying, yeah, we're not going to do anything. And what we're seeing is that electorally, they're getting a pass.
Yep. So if we're going to talk about integrity and ethics and lack thereof, let's turn and talk about my buddy Jerry Nadler for a minute. One of my two probably least liked current Congress people. And what happened this week with the Corey Lewandowski hearing, which for me became just a show of everything America hates about politics in a 10-minute video clip. During the impeachment movement, the impeachment hearing, whatever we're going to call this sham of a committee, Lewandowski gets up, wants Nadler to read to him from the Mueller report because he didn't have it in front of him, where he claimed to have said something about a meeting individually one-on-one with the president in the White House on a particular date. And at that point, it turns into bureaucracy at its finest. Do we stop the clock? Do we start the clock? What rules of procedure precede other rules of procedure? And the whole time, Lewandowski's just sitting there. He's almost smiling while this is going on, because he knows he is derailing the entire hearing just by doing this. So, Brian, what were your thoughts on that hearing? What were your thoughts on how the hearing itself was sort of conducted, Nadler's role as the chair, and how he kind of managed that even?
Oh, again, where to begin with this one? One of my favorite stories was actually published in the New York Post. And if our listeners don't check out the New York Post, it's the newspaper that if you're on a space shuttle, you could look down and see the headlines from space, right? So the New York Post has this really hilarious little article that references the Woody Allen film Bananas. And so I'm just going to quote from it because I think it captures the essence of it. There's not been a show like this since Woody Allen served as his own lawyer and cross-examined himself in movie Bananas. After declaring that the proceedings were a travesty of a mockery of a sham of a mockery of a travesty of two mockeries of a sham. This, in a nutshell, is what we got from the Lewandowski hearings. If we were to look at politics as theater and politics as comedy, Lewandowski scored big time. But if we look at it as sort of the tragic comedy, we see it for what it is, which is, you know, whether you love or hate Nadler, whether you love or hate the culture of investigation and the oversight role that Congress is required to play, what we see here is sort of a flagrant disregard for civility. It's basically this theater of demonstrating that we have no respect for the process. And we saw this, you know, and I make a parallel here between the Kavanaugh hearing and the Lewandowski hearing. And if we look at both of the parties that were involved, and let's not focus exclusively on the Judiciary Committee, let's not focus on Nadler's role with the Lewandowski hearing. Let's focus on the behavior of the individuals that are on center stage. Kavanaugh's behavior was not the behavior that we have ever seen or would expect to see of anybody who's up for a Supreme Court seat. On the other hand, similarly, Corey Lewandowski engaged in behavior that was blatantly defiant. And I think what it does is it reinforces this notion that you could say whatever you want to say, and I'm going to say whatever I want to say, and I'm going to do whatever I want to do, and nobody's really going to give a damn. And he was making a mockery of it. You know, can you tell me the page? And even when Nadler's pushing him and saying, even without a page reference from your memory, do you remember ever having this meeting? And he's like, yeah, kind of not going to address that till you tell me what page, what line, you know, what volume, you know, we're in. And
instruction at its finest.
Yeah, and it was...
And again, when I'm saying obstruction there, I'm not saying that that's
right.
criminal. That's just, that was obstructing the process in a way that stayed within the rules.
And it did. It stayed within the rules. And then, you know, we had the, you know, using the word filibuster was just dumb, right? And then, of course, somebody is there saying, well, you know, actually, filibuster is the Senate responsibility.
Across the hall. Yeah, not yeah, here.
Not here. And you can see the frustration, you know, more on one side than the other. And I think what this does, you know, for if we think about, again, the bigger picture, that when we talked about Kavanaugh earlier and how that's really theater about Trump, this is Lewandowski is really theater about Trump as well. And what we see in this regard is that hearings, you know, like this, they're increasingly being perceived by the American public as a circus. People are getting away with them being, you know, engaging in behavior that we wouldn't really imagine occurring. And what it does, I think, is it feeds a little bit of fuel into the fire of the Trump campaign that's saying, see, look what's going on now. Look at what they're doing. They keep going after these, you know, these other people trying to take me down, and they've got nothing. There's no smoke. There's no fire. And at the end of the day, we're just spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, we're up to the millions of dollars investigating something that has not resulted in anything that has touched the president. Now, sure, lots of other people have gone down. But we see with the Lewandowski situation right now, this is just the latest chapter in a story of what's being perceived to be a circus. And that I think also as, you know, as part of the reason why Nancy Pelosi has said, we're not going to pursue impeachment, because the public appetite for using a seemingly judicial process is just going to be made a mockery of. So I think Pelosi is kind of coming out of this looking a little bit more sensible, right? You know, because
but
people-
is it sensible? Or is it the fact that she knows if there was a move towards impeachment, it would show that she has zero control over her party in the House right now?
You know,
that's
part
of it for me, is that she knows that if the crazy comes out when impeachment starts.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't look well for her, especially if it's not successful.
Right. And I think, you know, politically, I don't think it's so much that her house is not in order. I think it's a matter of you only get to do this once. And in this regard, if we just look at her as a prosecuting attorney, and she's saying, we're not going to bring a case unless and until we have all this evidence. And then all the other junior prosecuting attorneys are like, we've got enough. We've got enough. Let's just do it. And she's exercising the discretion of saying, we have a lot, but it's not going to seal the deal. And I think she's being judicious in her decision making in this regard. But I think she's also, frankly, afraid that if this, you know, if we push these things too hard, it looks bad for the Democrats. And that's part of what Trump has been arguing, is like, look at those crazy Democrats wasting millions of dollars of taxpayer money, you know, going after me. And what have they got to prove for it? Nothing. Witch hunt. Right. It's a circus. Now, at the end of the day, I think it's also bad for democracy, because what we have right now are people taking the institutions and the processes that exist for a really important purpose, and we're forgetting about what that purpose is. And we're just seeing the behavior. And the behavior is making people say, we shouldn't do this. Stop doing this. Get away from this.
And you feel like this has to be their only chance at this point. Because if Trump wins re-election, so let's say he gets re-elected and wins the popular vote this time, you can't then decide you're going to start impeachment proceedings over things that the public knew about for the most part.
The clock's running out.
Yeah,
yeah,
the clock is up. Like, I feel like we're at a point where it's, you know, if you're going to even try this, you got to do it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, well, it's either it's now or it's very close, because it's got to be, no matter what's going to happen, it's sort of like the discussion about the American potential military response to Iran. The clock's ticking. You have to make a decision, and your decision might be to do nothing. But if you're going to act on impeachment articles, it's going to have to happen very, very soon and very rapidly and very decisively. But I think what it's doing is it's just feeding into this Trump narrative that the Democrats don't have their house in order. They're willing to spend millions of dollars on these witch hunts, and they produce nothing at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true, especially, again, with you go through these hearings and you have an opportunity to democratically take care of the problem. I'd be putting my energy towards that. And I would guess now, in all honesty, if I'm sitting in the House and I'm even a Democrat that's sitting in a moderate left district, I'm also worried about what's going to happen if people aren't happy. Maybe they don't like Trump, but they really don't like the thought of an impeachment hearing. That balance is still possible. So I think that adds to it as well. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. As soon as Brian and I are done recording this show, we'll be doing our special supporters exclusive show. This week, we're going to talk about the United Auto Workers strike, the GM strike, and then also talk about the latest against Justin Trudeau and what it could mean for his political future. If you're a supporter, that should be in your podcast app by the time you're listening to this, and that's just one of the supporters-only things we've got for you. To become a supporter, to find out more, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can go to politicsguys.com/support. If you have a question, comment, correction, or you just feel like sharing some thoughts with Brian or I or Mike, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com, our Facebook page. You can message us there. We post throughout the week. That's at facebook.com/politicsguys page, and we're on Twitter at politicsguys. Subscribing to the show really helps us out, as does sharing episodes. Word of mouth is really where we get most of our listeners, and we appreciate hearing from you and you telling others about it. Executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, and Andre Masker. Today's show is produced by Will Miller. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday, and we hope you'll join us then.